Hello, my name is Bea, and I'm camping in Union, Illinois. You're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
All right, we are getting some campfire weather in gear here. I love it. Thanks, B. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 942. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. So hello to Bob. And it is fantastic to have you along on the program today. Happy November. Here we go. Coming up on the show today, we get an update on a story about preserving the history of the Black Panther Party locally. We first talked about this story last December. Also, there's a crisis in the early intervention program for young children in Illinois. We get the lowdown on that. And the CEO of the Chicago Housing Authority is out of a job, and that's significant. We look at the importance of the housing issue in Chicago and what the latest is on filling that CEO position. Are some Chicago politics involved? Oh, yeah. Speaking of politics, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson announced his proposed budget for next year. And yes, we've all heard about the plan to raise property taxes in order to generate more revenue for the city. That's looking like a $300 million tax increase, by the way, the second highest in city history. But did you know that there are some other tax increases in this budget as well? Friend of this show, the proprietor of the At Chicago Bars Twitter handle, who happens to work, as he says, on behalf of Chicago bars, restaurants, and music joints, posted that the mayor's budget proposes a 33% increase in what's called Chicago's sin tax on beer, wine, and spirits. He says if the budget passes, the combined tax rates per gallon on alcohol in Chicago will be spirits, $14.61. That would be the second highest tax in the U.S. Right now, that rate is $8.55 per gallon. For beer, it would be 71 cents per gallon. That makes us the seventh highest in the U.S. The current rate is 29 cents. For wine, it would bring us up to $2.11 per gallon. That would make us the second highest tax for this in the U.S. The current rate, by the way, is just 89 cents per gallon. Okay, so bottom line here, there are some big increases in this plan. It might cost a lot more to be a barfly, if that's your thing. I mean, making a day of it in a local establishment watching a Bears game might even be more painful now. I saw this comment online, but I think it's worth thinking about. This person said, if this is how we're going to make money, the city might as well embrace video gaming. I mean, I'm no fan of video gaming, but something to think about, I guess. So this week we had the budget reveal. We had the brand new CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, selected by the mayor, by the way, resign after 7 days because it turns out he was posting anti-Semitic, misogynistic, and conspiratorial statements online. Oh, and the mayor's top campaign donor was arrested on murder for hire charges, and the mayor seems to be standing by him by not returning the campaign donation. Rough week for the fifth floor of City Hall. Some might even call it amateur hour. Earlier this week, it was announced that Chicago Housing Authority CEO Tracy Scott is leaving the agency after about 4.5 years. Over these years, the CHA has faced criticism for issues like letting homes fall into unlivable conditions and using public land for private enterprise. Mick Dumke is an investigative editor at Block Club Chicago, and he has been covering the housing beat, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop to discuss the significance of Tracy Scott's departure. We can check out what he's writing at blockclubchicago.org. Mick, always a pleasure, my friend. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back, Mike. Appreciate it.
You got it. I mean, you've been covering housing now for a few years, and it really is an important topic. And, you know, let's just start by talking about the importance of the Chicago Housing Authority, the CHA, because this agency provides apartments or rental subsidies to more than 65,000 households in Chicago. That's a substantial organization, isn't it?
It is, and a very important one and an undercovered one, in my opinion. At one point in time, Mike, both of the daily newspapers here as well as other local outlets had reporters who went to all the CHA board meetings and covered what they were doing, covered their announcements, dug into things like the plan for transformation, which you and I have talked about many times before, this huge two-decade-plus undertaking to remake public housing here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And at this point in time, it gets very little coverage. There's nobody, I think, who's covering it as a beat. And so one of the things we've tried to do at Block Club is to keep an eye on this very important multi-billion dollar agency, which, as you said, is a lifeline for thousands of families in the Chicago area. So they help a lot of people, but as anyone has noticed, around the Chicago area, there's tent encampments everywhere. There are people who are either openly homeless or essentially couch surfing, staying with people with a lot of housing insecurity around. So we feel this agency is as important as ever. And especially because of the under coverage, we have really tried to stay on what they're doing and what they're not doing as well.
Right. And you and I have talked on this show about some of the issues with housing, because this is something that is so vital. And like you were saying, the CHA doesn't always get the coverage, especially nowadays. I know you've been on the beat, but some more context here. Like I said, you've been on this program talking about housing many times recently and some of the struggles that the CHA has. And so when we talk about the problems here, and you've been on talking about various problems, but, you know, we're talking about serious issues like these poor living conditions and this land use, this public land that's been used for private business. So, I mean, that's just some of the criticism, but it's substantial. And I just would like you to provide some context for, like, the problems that the CHA has been having over the last few years.
Sure. And let me just say something to all of your listeners who might not think that they're impacted by this agency that provides housing assistance primarily to low-income people. Even if you're not directly affected by that mission, even if you're not one of the households that they serve, or you're just not interested in it. I mean, as a taxpayer, as someone who is concerned about the stability of the city of Chicago, someone who is concerned, frankly, about our social network and public safety, all these issues are interrelated. So I think the Housing Authority here in Chicago has a really important role to play in providing assistance that literally in some ways keeps people off the street, Mike, and helps them, have a stable environment for raising their kids. And, you know, again, just as watchdogs of taxpayer resources, that's another reason to pay attention to this. I also think that the CHA has such an interesting and complicated history in Chicago. Even growing up here, I grew up in Michigan, and coming into the city as a young person, I remember just driving up the Dan Ryan, which at that time was lined with public housing high rises. People know about the history of Cabrini Green, one of the developments near downtown. And so the stories of these places are intertwined with the history of Chicago. And all these issues we're talking about just impact its ability to kind of move forward. So there's kind of a pitch I make to people to please see the importance of this, not just in because you like to eat your vegetables to stay healthy, but also because it's super interesting, and yeah. It's just like an essential set of issues for the city going forward. So I think you're right. You summarized it very well. Under the tenure of Tracy Scott, the CEO of the Housing Authority for the last 4.5 years, they did provide housing to a lot of people, but in a lot of ways, they have struggled to deliver on their mission. You and I have talked on this show about some of the reporting I and my colleagues have done over the last couple of years that involves both backroom land deals, such as happened over on the Near West Side when the CHA basically turned over 23 acres of land to the Chicago Fire soccer team so they could build a practice facility.
Right.
This was done essentially deal forged behind closed doors for land that was supposed to be used for affordable housing, ranging from that to some other work we've done where at the time of this growing housing insecurity I mentioned, the CHA is sitting on hundreds of units of unused, basically apartments that are sitting there unused while people are sleeping in tents around the city. And in a lot of cases, the CHA has been collecting money from the federal government for this housing that no one is living in, which is like outrageous on a whole other level. So there have been a litany of issues we've tried to draw attention to, all in the interest of basically saying, hey, CHA, get your act together. You're needed more than ever. We think you're an important agency, and we're going to highlight what you're doing and, again, what you're not doing well, because your mission is just so important and essential to the city.
Right. And all that plus, let's not forget that there are more than 200,000 people on the waiting list for housing in Chicago. So there is this housing crisis, and there are units that are sitting empty. There are units that are not livable. We've got this public land where we could put more public housing or low-income housing, but we're selling it off to big billionaire-owned companies like the Chicago Fire. And so, yeah. I mean, people are struggling here, and the CHA, you know, it's this governmental agency, and hey, wouldn't it be great if government could help us out, you know?
Absolutely. And, the public housing of today is not what people imagine. If they have images of the public housing of like the eras I talked about before, they're not building high rises anymore. They have a whole model now of a mixed income model so that there are people from a range of incomes living in the same communities together. There's usually some kind of retail or business development attached to the housing they provide because they don't want to repeat the mistakes of before. They don't want people to be isolated and segregated. So they have worked really hard at that and made a lot of progress. The problem is there's just not enough of it given the need. So that's one of the reasons we keep hammering on it. I think this latest story, Mike, is also interesting and important because of what it says about Mayor Brandon Johnson at mm-hmm. this time. You know, he's certainly got his fans and his supporters, but he's taken a lot of pushback and a lot of criticism, especially recently over like moves at the Chicago Public Schools, for example. Similarly, in the housing advocacy community and people interested about housing issues, people have been just hoping that he would do something about the CHA and get them to sort of move and change direction, speed up the process of some of the things they're doing. And the ouster of Tracy Scott appears to be, from what we can tell, this is like the mayor finally making his move at the Housing Authority, saying it's time to bring somebody else in, shake things up. He's also added some new people to the board who have a record of working not just in housing, but in community development and working with some of the neighborhoods that are impacted by all this. So it does seem like he and his team are getting their act together when it comes to housing and the Housing Authority specifically. So I know a lot of advocates who've been calling for this kind of thing are really hopeful given what's happened this week.
Yeah, he hasn't said a lot about the CHA up until now. And then he finally makes the move where it looks like he pretty much ousts Tracy Scott. And he does have the power to choose the next CEO and the board members. So In terms of what we're looking for going forward here, I know that there are some issues that you raise about the transparency of the CHA, what's going on in terms of how it's going about its mission. So this is, as we look ahead here, just to kind of see how this plays out. I mean, there's a lot happening this week with talking about the budget and property tax increases. So we expect maybe, I mean, I know the mayor isn't didn't get back to you for in time for the story, but maybe soon we see some new leadership at the Chicago Housing Authority, courtesy of the mayor.
Yeah, they've named an interim CEO, Angela Herlock, who is a well-respected leader of a social service agency and has been on the CHA board, has chaired the CHA board for the last couple of years. So she certainly knows the agency. I think she's pretty well liked by people within the CHA, and housing advocates, you know, are just happy to see a change being made. Now, who the permanent leader is going to be, that remains to be seen. And how long it's going to take to name someone, that's also an open question, given that the mayor has taken a year and a half to make this move. And as with CPS, you know, when he asked for the resignation of the leader at CPS, Pedro Martinez, you know, it didn't appear that there was a plan in place for a replacement or, you know, what's going to happen if Pedro says no. A whole separate conversation we could have about that. Yeah. But I think some people, as encouraged as they are by the fact that the mayor and his team appear to be paying attention to the CHA, there's also some questions and concerns about whether they have a plan in place for what comes next. So, you know, we're going to be watching, we're going to be looking. At the moment, you know, again, the attention, the energy that being put into doing something different there is welcome. But we just need to see what happens next.
Well, I know that you will be watching Indeed, Mick, at Block Club Chicago. This is a really important issue. And when we talk about housing in Chicago, this does affect so many of us. And we can check out what Mick Dumke is writing at blockclubchicago.org. Mick is the investigative editor at Block Club Chicago. Mick, I always appreciate the time. Thank you so much for your insight and your reporting. And thanks for talking to us today.
Always, Mike. It's an honor to be on your show, and look forward to the next conversation.
Intervention is an important service for many infants and toddlers with or at risk of developmental delays or disabilities. This program provides a range of developmental and social-emotional services such as speech therapy, social work, and physical therapy. And children from birth until 3 years old, if they qualify, these services are provided for these children. And unfortunately, there is a staffing shortage and a backlog for children and their families when it comes to these important services. Advocates are calling on Governor Pritzker to increase funding for early intervention programs. Jonathan Doster is the Director of Legislative Affairs for an organization called Start Early. They are advocating for early intervention in Illinois. And Sarah Ziemba is a speech language pathologist in Illinois and the CEO of Shine Therapy. They're both here with us today and Outside the Loop. Jonathan and Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you both here. So, okay, let's talk about early intervention here. So, Jonathan, tell us how this works, because some of us might not know what this is. How does this work? How do kids qualify for these services?
It's a great question, Mike. So the early intervention program is a set of services for families with infants and toddlers who have a disability or developmental delay. Families come into the program many different ways. It could be a referral from their pediatrician. It could be a conversation between a parent and a child care provider. It could be a parent wondering whether or not their kid is meeting certain developmental milestones. The children are evaluated for services, and if they're deemed eligible, they can call their local child and family connections office in their community and receive an evaluation for care. And if they're deemed eligible for services, then the state has a legal responsibility to provide those critical therapeutic services to the children. And what's really great about early intervention is that it is a two-generation strategy. Providers are working to make sure kids are meeting their milestones, and they're working directly with parents and caregivers to help them support their child's trajectory and growth.
It really is an amazing thing that we have here. And I speak from experience. I've had my children go through early intervention years ago, and now they're 9 and 7 and they're doing great. And it was phenomenal to have this care, and this care came to our house, which was amazing. So, Sarah, I know that, like I said, you're a speech language pathologist. You do this work. So in terms of what you do, you are working with these kids, and the impact here, just talk a little bit about the impact that you see working with these kids over a period of time.
Sure. Yes. I've worked in the early intervention system for 25 years now as a speech pathologist, and it is a real honor to work in this system because we build good connections and relationships with the families that we see. And like you mentioned, we go right into their home environment. So the research has shown that in birth to three, kids are most comfortable, of course, around their parents and at home or at daycare, where they spend most of their time. And so that's the goal of the program, is to meet them in their natural environment where they spend most of their time, and to help figure out how to use things that are happening normally during the day already in families to build skills that we see concerns about. And so we are parent coaches. We coach the parents how to help their child through the day. And I think that is the part of the program that is so special, is that we're helping parents understand what's happening with their child. And we're helping them understand maybe why their child is struggling or having difficulty. So in my field, if a child can't talk, it's very frustrating for everyone. It can lead to a lot of tantrums and just generally difficult days. And that can disrupt the parent-child relationship too, because the parent's frustrated, the child's frustrated, and everybody is just retreating to their corners or going behind a screen.
Right.
And we get in there and teach the parents how to work with that child and support the steps to the next skills.
Yeah, again, it is just an amazing service when you get that one-on-one coaching, as you say, Sarah. I mean, it really is. That's part of it. And you get to work directly with these kids, and then the parents get to see how you're working with them. And so they get to continue that work when you're not there. And so this situation, the issue here, Jonathan, I'll ask you this question. I mean, there is a backlog. There's a waiting list of families just ready to get this service, and they can't do it. And like I said before, short staffing is part of this. But give us the sort of more detailed description of the problem here with what's going on with early intervention.
Our biggest problem in the early intervention program right now are historically high service delays. We have thousands of families across the state waiting for their service plan to be initiated. And those service delays have, on a percentage basis, have nearly doubled over the last 2 years. And when you look at the reasons why, it is tied directly to an ongoing workforce crisis in early intervention. We have underinvested in our providers for decades. When the state has started to look at the ways in which these developmental therapists or physical therapists or speech therapists are paid in comparison to their colleagues in other states, we're well behind. And they've also looked at, you know, what do we need to do to make sure that providers don't leave the field entirely, which has really been the result of the underinvestment over the last few decades. You know, these folks, many of whom have doctorates or master's degrees, many years of experience, they just can't make a living in EI anymore because of lagging reimbursement rates from the state. They can go work in private practice, they can go work in schools, they can work in hospital settings, and they can make far more money than they can make serving kids in the state program. And so you've got this challenge where we have increasing caseloads, which is great. We're actually identifying and finding infants and toddlers who need care, but we have a reduction in the number of people available to provide those services. And that's a really tricky math problem to solve.
So I know that you are advocating for greater funding for early intervention programs in the state of Illinois. So tell us about that, because this is a direct appeal to Governor Pritzker as we're thinking about budgets these days all over the place. But you'd like to see more money allocated for this really important service.
Yeah, we would. You know, I will give a tip of the cap to Governor Pritzker and his administration for prioritizing early care and education since day one of his first year in office. You know, he often says that we want to make Illinois the best state in the nation in which to raise young children, and we agree wholeheartedly. And they've done a ton of work over the last 6 years to make that a reality. That said, we know that we're not there yet, and we're feeling a particular pain point here in the EI program. I think our solution to this service delay crisis is investing in the workforce. And we know the only way we can do that is if we appropriate more funding out of the state budget to do so. And then hopefully the state would direct the money to the pockets of these providers who are working tirelessly to provide very, very important services to infants and toddlers with disabilities and developmental delays. So we are calling on the governor's office, as well as leaders in the General Assembly, to prioritize early intervention this coming fiscal year. We think a $60 million increase in state funds for this program would allow the state to substantially increase provider reimbursement rates, which would allow providers currently serving families to hopefully increase their caseloads, serve more kids, and we would hopefully over time encourage more providers to enter into the EI system. That's really the only way we're going to actually get families their services in a timely manner.
Sarah, have you felt some of the struggles working in this field, getting out there, doing this work with kids in early intervention? Have you felt some of the pain points here?
Yeah, it's really an emotionally heavy field to be in right now, because we're often sitting in meetings and recommending services and strategies that we know would really help families, but knowing they aren't going to be able to access those services and help. And so that is a really difficult position to be in as a provider. And I think when we think about the end result of having these services in early intervention, at the end of it, we have a more confident parent, a more supported child, and sometimes that little bit of help is all that child needs. So we'll sometimes provide just a little boost of therapy, maybe a year or two, and then kids catch up and they're ready for preschool and elementary school. But when they miss early intervention, the therapy process is just going to take longer. From birth to five, a child's brain is really neuroplastic, which means that their brains are growing rapidly and they're adapting and they're learning new skills and picking things up more quickly, which makes our services more effective and more efficient. And so that investment in early intervention would not only help families, but it's cheaper for taxpayers in the end. And that's not even addressing the issues that we have in the classroom when this group of children who hasn't had access to this help is showing up on their first day of preschool or kindergarten with still needing a significant help. And then that has consequences for our teachers and classrooms that are already struggling in the state.
Well, this is work that I think is just incredible. It is so important. And we talk about, okay, let's get $60 million towards this early intervention program. It sounds like a lot of money, but I'll tell you, when you're a parent and your kid goes through this and you see the end result, it is just it's an emotional thing, and it's a wonderful thing. So we could check out the website startearly.org if we want to know more about early intervention programs in our state. And Jonathan Doster is the Director of Legislative Affairs for the organization Start Early. And Sarah Ziemba is a speech language pathologist in Illinois and the CEO of Shine Therapy. Jonathan and Sarah, thank you so much for talking to us today about this issue. Best of luck going forward, and you're both doing some great work.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Last December here on the show on Outside the Loop number 894, I spoke with Layla Wills. She's the executive director of the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. We talked about a project that was aimed to preserve the history of this group locally. In 1969, party leaders Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were assassinated by the Chicago police in their apartment at 2337 West Monroe on the west side of the city. And Chicago played an important role in the history of the Panthers. The free breakfast program for children started by the Black Panthers, as well as free health clinics, made an incredibly positive impact on a community that faced local discrimination in the mainstream. Layla spearheaded a project to preserve this history so we know a more complete story of the civil rights era. So let's rewind to December of last year and hear part of the conversation we had, beginning with the plan for this project.
We're landmarking the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. We are creating what is called a thematic listing with the state of Illinois and the National Park Service. So I usually use some kind of comparison. If we were going to say 1800 schoolhouses from the 1800s in Illinois, right? We want to landmark those. And so they may be scattered throughout the state as the Black Panther sites are. But when you connect them all under the work and programs, they do tell the story of the Illinois chapter. So that's what we're doing. And we presented to the city of Chicago and we presented to the state of Illinois. And it's now at the National Park Service and they have to vote on this thematic listing. So the end goal is adding the Panther Party's history to the state of Illinois' history for generations to come, whether we're here or not. And I do want to say that both of my parents were in the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and I've been working with over 30 of them to make this happen.
When we're thinking about these locations here, right? So getting these areas on a National Register of Historic Places, what does that actually do for these places? Is it like a preservation so they can't be demolished, or what does that entail?
Well, it's honorific. It's an honorary category for the properties. However, so it doesn't stop demolition per se, but what it does do is urban planners and city planners will take these cultural heritage spots under consideration as they do urban planning and could help save some of these properties and neighborhoods. One of the properties that we have, 1320 South Kedvale, it's almost the last property on a block in on the west side. Like it's almost the last building standing. So that's what we're trying to do, is save some of these places, do some placemaking, create programs around it, and teach this history. And then, of course, there's opportunities for cultural tourism and that kind of thing, and for people to just visit these places themselves. So we are just trying to mark the state's history and create programs and markers. Like that'll be phase two once we pass the Park Service, is to get actual markers at some of our more significant properties.
That was from Outside the Loop number 894 back in December of 2023. And an update to this story. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for the Historical Preservation Society of the Illinois Chapter of the Black Panther Party. Received 13 historical markers that will be placed at the sites of historical significance in the Chicagoland area. Outside the Loop. This thematic listing was approved by the National Register of Historic Places, and they are building a website so we can get the history of these places anytime. Some great news about this story.